3, 2,
Hello everyone, I'm Joe Cristiano and welcome to Liberty Talk Radio, your radio of reason and independent streaming internet radio station and libertarian voice, broadcasting 24 hours a day, 7 days a week from our studio in Tulsa, Oklahoma to around the world. This broadcast is being brought to you live on Sunday evening, October 14, 2007. It is now 8:01 Central Daylight Time in the good old USA. Liberty Talk Radio is your antidote to popular talk radio. Here you are expected to do more than just listen, and you are expected to think. Although we broadcast from the United States, libertarian principles of individual freedom and responsibility are universal and apply to your area of residence, be it New York, Bangkok, Berlin, or Stalingrad. Folks, it's time for us to take back control of our government now before this bureaucratic, oversized, self-serving federal government starves us of our property, our freedom, our rights, and our liberty. To do this, we must shed conventional thinking regarding our political structure. We need to be revolutionaries in thought, dissidents in action. Only after we recognize what our government is doing to our freedom and our Constitution will we start taking it back. And this program is just about that. Now, on to our program. Good evening, everyone. During our live broadcast, we invite you to call 646-652-4620 and we'll take your comments while on the air. At other times, you may call 903-551-2186 to leave a voice message. Of course, you may send us email at any time to comments@libertytalkradio.com. We'll try to respond to your questions during our next broadcast. In addition to accessing Liberty Talk Radio from our website, you may now access our broadcast from blogtalkradio.com/Liberty Talk Radio. I also encourage you to get educated on economic issues. Go to Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com, and that two is a numeric two, so it's mytwocentsonline.com. He discusses economic issues and how they affect you. This is particularly important in these very turbulent financial times, folks. For your own protection, go to that website and read the material. Is a question and answer period section in there now that answers many of the questions in Dick and Jane language, layman language, to understand a little bit better the liquidity or the credit crisis and how it is going to affect you one way, shape, or form. Well, good evening, everyone. This is Sunday evening, not my favorite time to be broadcasting because it's the end of the week and I like to be winding down, and unfortunately, when I have a program, I have to wind up. But here we are today. I'd like to start with a few emails. We got a bunch of emails last week. I'll pick out four of them. The first one here is, this is from Chris from Florida. My name is Chris from Florida, and I'm a first-time listener. I was excited to hear you mention Ron Paul on your new broadcast. I have been following him for a few months now, and I've just recently changed my affiliation from independent to Republican, so I can vote for him. Well, I did the same thing, Chris. I agree with you on women's rights to choose. Dr. Paul's stance on this is that he is pro-life, but Roe versus Wade should be overturned, and that abortion should be handled on a state level. You know, I can't argue with that. I really can't argue with that because the federal government should not be trumping states' rights. So I give Dr. Paul, Ron Paul, credit for that. We have to understand, folks, this program is about liberty, and we have to understand the concept of liberty, the very, very concept of it. Hold on one second. We have a caller. Let's see who that is.
Hi, Joe.
Yes. Liberty Talk Radio, you're on the air.
This is Jimmy Cook. How are you doing this evening?
Very good, Jimmy. Thank you for calling in. What can we do for you?
This is a little bit unrelated to your topic, but I wanted to let your listeners know if there are any that are in the area of Oklahoma City that would be available to on the 23rd of this month. Former Congressman Bob Barr is going to be in Oklahoma City at the North Holiday Inn to speak and to help with a fundraiser for the Oklahomans for Ballot Access Reform.
All right. What is the Oklahoma for Ballot Access Reform for the benefit of our listeners, please, Jimmy?
What they're trying to do is they're trying to change the restrictive ballot access laws in Oklahoma. Right now, the law requires 5% of the last gubernatorial or presidential election in order to establish a political party. And we are trying to change the law back to what it originally was at a 5,000 signature requirement to establish a party. And something Bob Barb had heard about and had volunteered to fly to Oklahoma from Atlanta, Georgia to speak with us.
An absolutely uphill fight, I'll bet.
Yeah, it is.
What are your chances of overturning that legislation? That law?
I think our chances are pretty good. What we're doing is trying to collect petition signatures to get it on the ballot so that the voters of the state of Oklahoma can decide this issue rather than the legislators.
Okay, I agree, as you know. Jimmy, for the benefit of our listeners, will you give us the time and place again, please?
It's going to be to the Holiday Inn North, which is at 6200 North Robinson Avenue, and it'll be at 7 p.m. He'll be there about 6 p.m., so people can get the chance to speak with him personally if they would like to before the program begins.
And what's the date?
And, there'll be a dinner for a $30 donation, or if someone isn't interested in having the dinner, they can come for $10 and they can sit and just watch him speak and participate in a discussion with him if they'd like to beforehand.
Okay, would you please repeat the date? What day is it?
The date is October the 23rd.
October 23rd, Oklahoma City. Okay, very good, Jimmy. Thank you very much for calling in. I hope that musters up some troops for you.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Folks, as you can imagine, Oklahoma has the most restrictive ballot access law on the books. Basically, you wind up getting over 100,000 signatures to have someone place their name on the ballot with their political affiliation. Now, isn't that absolutely ridiculous? Now, you can run as an independent, but if you want to run as a libertarian, you need to get somewhere around 100,000. Of course, they throw a lot out. I think it's 80,000 or whatever Jimmy said it was. But they wind up getting like 100,000 signatures, and then they throw a bunch out and for some reason, and they wind up with a net figure. And then you can place your party affiliation. Now, if that's not an autocratic, dictatorial, unliberty type of approach to things, how the political parties can maintain a rule such as that in the state of Oklahoma when no other state has anything close to it is beyond my comprehension. And yet it's been on the books for years that way. Anyway, thank you very much for calling, Jimmy. I hope you have a good turnout. And I hope you're very successful. Okay, back onto this email. He says, I agree with you on women's rights to choose. Dr. Paul's stance is that this pro-life, he is pro-life, but Roe versus Wade should be overturned and that abortion should be handled on a state level. Now, if you recall, I had mentioned that I had disagreed with Ron Paul on the women's right to choose issue. We may be on the same side of the fence where he is in disagreement. He doesn't agree that the federal government should be dictating to the states what the states should be legislating on their own. I believe he's a big states' rights man, which he should be. Anybody who believes in the original Constitution would have to understand that the states trump the federal government. The federal government does not trump the states. The states are sovereign. The United States is not. Not in the same light. We have 50 sovereign states. And unless one of the states break break the rule of the Constitution, can the federal government intercede? Now, we have to understand that, folks, because the states basically have very, very few rights. And one reason why they have very few rights is they allow the government, to take that position. The reason why they take that position is you have to follow the money. You hear that a lot from me. Follow the money. The states get much of their money from the federal government. Now, they have to comply with the federal government or they lose their aid. That's coercion. That's exactly what the federal government does. It coerces people to do things. It coerces the states to do things. You know, it's one big bureaucratic iron fist. And it's being shoved down everyone's throat. I agree, right? So I agree with Ron Paul there. He goes on to say that the abortion should be hidden. Yeah, on immigration, he is against putting up a wall. I'm glad to hear that. But believes in taking illegals' rights away, free education, health care, etc. I agree with him 100% on that one. He says, I think it would motivate more illegal aliens. You know, it's tough to disagree with that. The only problem that I have with that comment is that I don't understand the definition of illegal. Just because the United States wants to put a higher quota on people from Denmark who have technical degrees and a lower quota on people with little education but would do the farming, being people from Central America and in Mexico, those people who come up here and risk their lives to pick out lettuce and work in our fruit groves and whatever, those people are illegal. I have a big problem with the definition of legal, and I think we should all start thinking about that. Right? Now, I don't want illegal immigration, but there should be a way, and a very easy way, for us to accommodate those people who are literally dying to get here and die to work. Now, I'm going to go off on a tangent for a minute, and please bear with me. I ride bicycles. My wife and I ride bicycles. I have recumbent bike, and I've crossed the state 13 times. I don't bike too much anymore. I've got really bad knees, unfortunately. I do run a little bit, but I do some race walking, etc. I also ride motorcycles. Now, here is my point. I was in my garage today, and I had to work on my bike and my wife's bike. And it was a beautiful day out. It was not hot. It was cool. Sun was out. It was an absolutely gorgeous day, just a perfect day. And yet, I was standing in my garage on my feet, you know, in on the concrete. And there's always, whenever the sun comes out in Oklahoma, bugs grow immediately. And they're nipping at my heels, you know, and I've got little bites on my heels. Now, maybe because my cats spend a lot of time in the garage there, and there may be fleas in there. I don't know. But I stood there, and I said, I can't wait to finish up working on these two bikes. And I did, and I went inside. I said, you know, here I am complaining that I spent an hour or two in the garage working on my bicycles, right, on a beautiful day in the shade, you know, doing what I want to do for myself. And I complained about it because it was uncomfortable. And I thought to myself, after I got into my house and I actually had to wash my legs off because they were so itchy from the bugs, that I thought to myself, I said, could you imagine I'm complaining? What about those people who risk their lives to come here, come to America, to work in the fields, bug-infested fields, sometimes over 100 degrees, 8 to 10, 12 hours a day, you know, for practically nothing. And I'm complaining. You see, folks, you understand where we're coming from. Is that where do we have the right to tell these people they can't suffer for our benefit? Anyway, that whole immigration issue just about drives me nuts. Absolutely drives me. Now, people complain that they don't want people to have access to free health care. Well, then you don't have a problem with immigration. You have a problem with the welfare state. Get rid of the welfare state, and then illegal immigration would not be a problem. Other people complain that law enforcement, you know, refuses to arrest these people, put them in jail, and then go through all the proper channels because there's too much paperwork to deport them or whatever, or, you know, retain them. So they let them go. Well, you don't have a problem with illegal immigration. You have a problem with the bureaucratic nonsense that the police officers have to go through in order to arrest somebody. And I don't blame them. These guys are overworked and underpaid, you know. And you may have a problem with the police officer if he's not doing his job. And anyway, I just get too damn upset with that same issue. Okay, here's another email. This is from Paul. Paul is from Ackworth, Georgia. I heard your show on Saturday, October 13th. You wanted to know about cigarette prices. Oh, yes, I did, Paul. All right. Well, the United States average price is about $4.54 a pack. Holy smoke! When I smoked, it was 22 cents a pack. My goodness gracious. I have attached the PDF document showing the breakdown of each state's prices as well as the national average I just mentioned. And I said I'd send him a T-shirt. He says, yeah, I want a T-shirt. So, Paul, a T-shirt is coming your way. Very good. Thank you very much. And the attachment's excellent, by the way. I just take a quick look at it right before the broadcast. And what's really interesting is that the factory price of the cigarettes is about $2.28 a pack. Federal tax is standard all the way through for each state, obviously. It's only 39 cents. Then the distributor markup is relatively low. It runs from about $1.27 down to 38 cents. Ooh, wow, that's pretty low. And now here's the biggie. The state cigarette tax, right, in New Mexico is $2.57.5, and a pack of cigarettes is $6.45. So the cigarette tax is more than the tax, more than the cost of manufacturing the cigarettes. Folks, there's something wrong with that. I don't care if you think smoking's good, bad, or indifferent, immoral, or moral. Forget about that. Here we have. Now, what's interesting, and then they have a sales tax on it of 37 cents. So you have to add the 37. So you get almost $3, well, a little less than $3 a pack in state taxes. And then if you add on the federal tax, you're well over. You're like $3.20 on a pack of cigarettes that only cost $2.28. Wow. And here it is. There's a total here of the total federal and state taxes, $3.33. Maine is also very bad, $2 in state cigarette tax, $5.65. Michigan is $2. Rhode Island, $2.46, $6.22 a pack, $2. You know, people are now smoking, and they're paying $6 a pack. If they add another dollar, you know, folks, they're going to continue smoking. It's not going to make that much difference. If it was the difference between $1 and maybe $5, I could see the jump. But this is an easy way for the states to collect money. And for the federal, no, not for the states, for the federal government to collect a little bit more money. They'll add something on, and maybe, you know, if they're shrewd, which they are, they will not add on a dollar tax all at once. They'd say they're going to be kind. They're going to give people an opportunity. I bet they say this. And they'll do it in increments, like they'll add 25 cents every 6 months or every quarter or something like that. Well, that's the proverbial frog in the warm water bit with the heat being turned up. You know, you get accustomed to the price, and then you don't stop smoking because the intent, don't stop smoking. We need the money. We don't give a damn if you drop dead of smoke. Just show me the money. And that's our federal government for you. Okay, here's another one. I found you Googling Libertarian Talk Radio to get away from the bias of mainstream talk radio. I must say it's a good show. Thank you so much. This is from Andrew. I don't know where Andrew is from. I'm listening through the archives. I wanted to point out that there are some broken links to MP3. Thank you for pointing that out. Andrew, I'll send you email asking you this, but I'll also ask on the air if you can indicate which links you had a problem with. I'll see if our program people can correct that. And for doing that, I will send you a Liberty Talk Radio T-shirt. Be our pleasure. The next one and the last piece of email that I will read this evening, let's say we have no callers, good, is from Robert. It says, this is a long email. I'll just read the introductory. It's two pages long, no, a whole page long in small print. And I would just want to read the first paragraph to give you the sense. He says, this might be something to keep an eye out for and definitely needs more research to confirm, but I have heard that historically it is the sinking of the world's second or third economy that usually drags the world into depression. Thinking about it, I don't believe the United States was a world top economy at the start of the last Great Depression, was it? And no, I don't think it was. I think Britain was the financial capital. London was the financial capital of the world at that time, or they were jockeying, they were losing their position at the time. I'm not really sure. He says, so if the thesis is close to being correct, or even if not, perhaps we don't need to necessarily watch our currency and economy, but rather we perhaps should be keeping an eye on Japan's. I absolutely agree. And the reason why I agree with that, Robert, is because all of the currencies are so inextricably intertwined. I think with the demise of one currency, you will find that all the currencies will follow suit. Just like if, let's say, for example, the Argentine currency goes bust, that would adversely affect Brazil, and that would start a chain reaction. Now, with all the hedge funds out there, and the hundreds, and folks, listen to this number, please, hundreds of trillions of dollars in market value on hedge funds. If there is a currency crisis, you will have a major blow up of all the financial systems around the world. They will all collapse almost instantaneously. So we have to be careful not only of our currency, but of other world currency. Now, here is the danger. The danger is that our currency is used sometimes to prop up other currencies. If our currency gets weak, other currencies may be stronger in relation to the dollar. But remember, I said one time at the American Institute of Economic Research, when they did a white paper on currencies around the world, they said, and this was a year or so ago, they said that the U.S. dollar is the world's tallest dwarf. And I like that statement. The world's tallest dwarf, meaning don't bank on it. So if the U.S. dollar goes, it will drag other currencies with it. There will be a collapse. The hedge funds won't be able to cash in fast enough to close their positions out, and you'll have a total collapse of our financial system. Folks, you must separate yourself. You must divorce yourself from the U.S. dollar. If you have all your money in savings in U.S. dollars, it's time. First thing tomorrow morning is to correct that situation. Either buy stocks, equities, buy real estate investment trusts, and not mortgage trusts, but real estate investment trusts. And those things are kind of not shaky, but they're a little down right now because of the credit crunches. I'm talking about commercial property, or buy into commodities or precious metals. You want to get out of the dollar-denominated stuff. Okay, get back into equities. All right. I read an article before we get on to ethanol, which is going to be our main subject for this evening. I read an article by the Future Freedom Foundation. It's an article by Anthony Gregory, The Diagnosis of a Dying Republic. And this is part two. I already read part one. I just finished reading part two. And it's a summary of the book by Chalmers Johnson. And it's an excellent book, folks. If you're in a good mood and you really want to get depressed, read this book. Fabulous book. I haven't read the book yet. I've read just a summary, a detailed summary of the book. It looks great. It's called Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. And in here, and I want you to keep this in mind when we start talking about our liberties and our freedom and how we are so reliant on what Bernanke, good old Benny Bernanke, does with the U.S. dollar and how that affects us. And that's why I suggest that you go to the Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com. He outlines this in plain English. The guy is an economist. He's degreed. He's intelligent. He knows his bananas, and he tells it like it is, and he makes it understandable. It's important if you want to save your hide, if you don't want to be the sheeple, as they say, and you want to follow the herd, and you're going to go right to slaughter. And that's exactly where our currency and where Ben Bernanke is sending us and where our Federal Reserve is sending us. You know, you'll read that website and get yourself prepared. But this is what he says, and it's very disturbing. He says, the American Republic is dying, and there is precious little time to save it. If you doubt the situation is dire, read Nemesis. If you are like me, you will be frustrated, but as determined as ever to do whatever you can to show your fellow Americans what is happening in the hope of reversing course, ending the empire and restoring the American Republic. Those are absolutely chilling words. I mean, if a tsunami doesn't hit the East Coast and destroy this country, or if there's not a major earthquake splitting this place in half, or there's not a virus that comes and kills half the population, it'll be this Federal Reserve system and this financial network that's built up where people are making tons and tons and tons of money just for shuffling paper. People are no longer the industrial barons. They're the financial barons. Financial barons are making money today. Those are the people making the big bucks. And I heard the CEO of Vanguard Group, the guy who started the Vanguard Group, being the low-cost mutual funds, index funds that you can buy directly, of which my company participates in that. We use Vanguard in our IRA for our employees. And it's worked very, very well for everyone. I forgot his name. I'm sorry. I don't remember his name, but he's the founder and CEO of Vanguard. And he was on television being interviewed, and he said something interesting. He said, we cannot continue to be a financial, just a financial powerhouse. He said, we cannot keep on increasing wealth of individuals who do nothing but shuffle paper. All they do is take the same dollar and take it from one place and put it into another, and they make an absolute fortune. And he says, you can't build a country on this. You know? And I think he's right. Not think he's right. I know he's right. Which leads me, I had this written somewhere. Here it is. Leads me to comment on, I believe it was some... It was on the web, and I can't tell you which news broadcast I saw it on, which newsletter. But also my wife heard this on television, and it was this. It said the wealthiest 1% of the population earned 21.1% of all income. Now, that's an all-time high. Now, that's amazing, isn't it? That is absolutely amazing. Now, most of the people in that 1% are these financial people I'm talking about. But I want to go further. I just want to walk through this very quickly, and then we'll get on to ethanol. What happens here is that you find that the politicians will take this statistic. And, oh, by the way, before it was 19%. So it's up 2%, which is significant. But it's always been very high. And in every civilization, it's always been that way. No matter how far back you go, you'll find the top 1% earn a large portion of the money. I mean, that's the way it's always been. I don't think you can reverse that. But I obviously, if it continues to go up by 2% a year, for example, eventually the top 1% will be earning 50% of the income. Then we have a real problem. But we're reaching critical mass now with that number. But let me explain something. So what do? The politicians play that up. And they say, you know, something's got to get done. It's not fair to the poor working person, blah, 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 blah. Now, why is that figure up? Well, think about it. People who are in that category really don't make a salary. They don't necessarily just earn money. They have their money, and their income is from investing their money. So they're making their money from investments. In other words, they take the money they earn, which is in U.S. dollars, and then they convert it. They convert it to equities, for example. Right? They put it into hedge funds. They buy precious metals and commodities. In other words, they're doing exactly what I'm suggesting that everyone do. So when they remove themselves from the dollar right? The dollar loses value while things of value, items of value gain in value. So their income goes up, you know, their wealth goes up. They make out on the deal. If they did nothing, they would make out on the deal just by virtue of the fact that they're in the right place at the right time. Now, let's take the lower 25% of the income earners in America. I would suspect that most of them don't have much invested, you know, unless they have a 401k plan at work, and there's probably not much money in it because I think the average is only $73,000. But most of that money is tied in is cash. They get money in and they spend it that week. In other words, they live paycheck to paycheck. Well, when you do that and you're making the same dollar, but the dollar gets weaker and buys less, your income goes down. You may be making the same dollar amount, but your income is down just by virtue of the fact that everything else costs more. I complain about this every time I go to the supermarket. The price of fruit and vegetables, I mean, is through the roof. Well, I still buy it, but what if the people who are just living week to week, you know, when they're accustomed to buying spinach for 49 cents a pound, and then all of a sudden it's 89 cents a pound, and they still need to buy the spinach or something, or a substitute, and they're all expensive today, what happens to them? Well, their income, in fact, goes down. They're not gaining anything. Now, I'll be honest with you. I've been very, very disciplined in making sure that I don't keep money around. I don't buy things. I don't have a lot of things. I'll be honest, I don't want it. There's nothing that I really want. You know, I have this radio program because I feel this is my contribution to the liberty of America. And I really mean that. I get nothing from this radio program. And the only things that I do get from this program is I get emails once in a while say, Joe, that was a good show. Thank you very much for what you're doing. And every time I want to give up and I say, you know, this is too much work. I mean, this is all I do every week, every day is I'm working on this program. And I don't have to. I don't get paid a dime on it. I get email like that. And it puts me back, puts everything back in perspective. Well, that's why I'm doing it. I'm doing it, folks. Let me be honest with you. I'm doing it for myself. Number one, and I'm doing it for everyone out there. I wanted to make a contribution, and this is the way I'm making my contribution. It's a tough way to do it, much easier to write a check. But my point is that I have been very disciplined almost all my life, you know, when it comes to money. And now I have a nice nest egg. Well, I have most of my money in what? In equities, real estate investment trusts. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention foreign stocks, currencies, as well as commodities and precious metals. That's exactly where I have my money. And I have done very, very, very well. I make a lot more, you know, I make a lot more now just on my investments every year than I ever made working, even on the best of years. Well, the people in the lower income don't have that opportunity. I'm saying I identify with that. Now, I'm not the 1%. Maybe I'm the 10%, top 10%, but I'm not in the top 1%. But my point being is that the people, the politicians are going to cater to the people who are living week to week, or the middle income who is getting squeezed, and that's going to be a majority of the population. And you say, well, they should. That's why we have politicians, to protect the poor guy, you know, the underdog. But listen, folks, when it comes time to campaign, right, you hear the rhetoric. Where do the politicians get their money? From whom? From the person who's living week to week? No. They get their money from the big boys, the money makers. They get their money from this 1%. Now, why do you think it's so much easier for the 1% to get richer and for those others not to? Well, because it's designed that way. If you inflate the dollar, You're making the masses pay for your ills, for all of your errors, for all of your boondoggles, for all of your waste. You're making the people who are working day to day, you know, week to week, these are the people who are picking up the tab. Not the big money changers. They know where to put their money. So the legislature is, in fact, in charge of that. They're the ones that make the tax laws. They're the ones that control, you know, what the Federal Reserve does. I mean, you know, by implication. And yet, and that's where they get their money from to get into office, to stay in power. But then when they campaign, they talk about how they're going to protect the They say that every time. Do they ever do it? Absolutely not. They can't. Because they're not going to cut off the hand that's feeding them. You see how rotten this whole situation is? So if you want to scream, you want to blame anybody, don't go to your legislature and say, we need more legislation. No, blame your legislature. Blame the legislature and you'll find. Just follow the money, folks, and you'll find out exactly where the money comes from, how it's used, and then how the people respond, how the politicians respond to the people. Okay, all right, enough of that. Ethanol. Another subject that I just absolutely love, ethanol. Ethanol is going to be apparently the salvation of America. We have an energy crisis, and we have to meet the challenge of the energy crisis. And the way our politicians say we're going to do this is through ethanol. Now, why would they say that? Because they are interested in saving America? No, you have to follow the money, folks. This is a country of politicians. This is a money of big money people, a country of big money people, all of whom are making a fortune at our expense. And the lower on the income ladder you are, the more you pay. You understand that? The lower you are on the income ladder, the more you pay. That sounds kind of disastrous, isn't it? You see, now that I'm retired and I have most of my income from investments, I realize that. I realize that I don't have to work every day to make ends meet. So all the people who have to do that and work in dollar-denominated currency, you know, and paychecks, basically, and they just go out to spend their money and buy things day to day, are finding it increasingly more difficult. Now, how does this relate to ethanol? Well, do you think they want ethanol because ethanol is good for our country? No, they're not that stupid. They know ethanol is a boondoggle. They know ethanol is too expensive. They know ethanol is an ecological nightmare. They know ethanol uses so much water that most farmlands that are being prepared for corn crops, don't even have enough water to support it. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. But what happens is that the politicians get paid. They're the ones that are in bed with those people who are making the most from this ethanol boondoggle. You have to understand that. Let's go through it. The government regulations, and we need more regulations, obviously, because we're totally out of control. We want to increase the fuel economy averages to 35 miles per gallon from 27.5, which is it's today, to 35. Well, folks, number one, ethanol, at best, now I'm going to say at best, gets you about 75% of the octane that regular gasoline gives you. So that means that, and there are some who say that it only gives you 50%. Now, I don't want to get in that argument because I don't know who's right. And maybe it's a matter of temperature, altitude, and stuff like that, of whether or not, you know, how much power you get out of each gallon of ethanol versus gasoline. But let's say it's somewhere between 50 and 75%. Well, that means you need to produce increasingly more ethanol right, for each gallon. Now, since the price of gasoline, and I know the price of gasoline recently has gone down, but it'll continue to go up. It yo-yos, but it yo-yos on the top side. Remember that. It always keeps on going up. It doesn't keep on going down. And so we will increasingly pay more and more for gasoline. Now, if the gasoline contains ethanol and we're getting fewer miles per gallon, what do you think the consequences of that are? Right now, you're getting fewer miles per gallon, so you're paying more. You're buying more gallons. That means more of your disposable income is being used for gasoline. Now, who is most reliant on gasoline on their cars, and which group does gasoline have the most impact on their total income? Well, you just go down the ladder. It's a regressive tax. Ethanol is a regressive tax because they now the people at the bottom still have to buy the gasoline, but they're getting fewer miles per gallon, even if they keep their old cars. Now, here's the kicker. Ethanol doesn't work at all in cold temperatures. In fact, it cannot be transported via pipeline in cold temperatures. It'll only work in warm temperatures. If it is burnt in cold temperatures, it results in a smog. It'll create a smog. It creates a pollution problem. Isn't that something? Right? And now, it can be transported in the wintertime, but it's got to be done by tank truck, which is a lot more expensive than pipeline. So that's going to be expensive. They want to go from, I think, just a couple of gallons of ethanol. Let me see. I have the figure right here. Let me see. Yeah, I'm sorry, gallons. They want to go from 4.7 billion gallons this year to 36 billion gallons in the year 2022. And I read another article that mentioned 2017. I don't know why there was a disparity there. It could be that the laws changed, they've accelerated it, or one could be a mistake. But anyway, in the near future, they want to go from 4.7 billion, which is being produced now, to 36 billion. Now, that means there's going to be more and more ethanol. That means fewer miles per gallon. That's going to mean that we're going to be buying more gallons for the same amount of driving that we do. That is a tax on the consumer. Now, then the consumer, it's a regressive tax because the lower your income, you're still going to buy the same amount of gasoline. It takes a proportionally larger part of your take-home pay. Now, the 1% or the 10% or some people like me, it doesn't make any difference. First of all, if the gasoline gets too high, heck, I'll take the bus, I'll walk, I just won't go anywhere. I don't have to work. I'll just get on my radio program, which, you know, it's in the studio. So you have to understand that people who rely on their cars are going to have a real problem, and those are the people, are the working people who are currently being squeezed. So one for ethanol. Now, but think through this. If, in fact, the new car, the ethanol becomes more and more dominant in gasoline, and the new cars will run efficiently on ethanol, and the old cars will not. We're going to have a problem. I mean, people are going to have to buy new cars. Now, if the old car can run on ethanol as well as the new car, and people are spending more money in gasoline, they may not buy a new car. In other words, it could hurt the auto industry. And if it hurts the auto industry, what that means is that the people who make the cars, again, we go down to the people at the lowest rung on the economic ladder, those are the people who get hurt the most. People will not buy new cars, you know, if they can't afford them. Now, aside from the economic issues, right now, ethanol is extracted from corn. Brazil uses ethanol, but they get their ethanol from the waste from the sugar they get from the sugar cane, but not the sugar itself, but from, you know, the stalks and stuff like that. And they have a different process. Now, I don't know why we don't do that here, but we are actually actually using the corn. Now, here's the main problem. With ethanol being subsidized, heavily subsidized by the government, and by the way, when I say heavily subsidized, the government assists with loan guarantees for people who want to build and run ethanol plants. They subsidize the farmers for growing it. I mean, there's subsidies, government subsidies all over the place. So everybody pays that through inflation and further taxes. Now, who gets hurt the most? Well, the working person. And the working person is the one that's being convinced that ethanol is good for America. You have to understand there is no energy crisis. There is absolutely no energy crisis. The way it should work is we should buy our fuel. We shouldn't be fighting. We shouldn't have our ships there. We shouldn't have bases there. We shouldn't have armies there. We shouldn't be interfering with their governments, putting people in power, supporting them or not supporting them. We should leave everyone alone. If, in fact, the cheapest place to buy our crude oil, our barrels of crude, would be from Saudi Arabia, because you put a stick in the ground, the stuff comes squirting up. If that's where we should go, we should buy it from them and bring it over here. And then we, in turn, should make the machinery and stuff that they need to pump the oil out, to refine it, to, you know, we should sell them toilet paper and food stuff and whatever, things that they can't make. It should be an open and free exchange. That's free. That's liberty. But what we're doing now is that, you know, we're trying to protect our oil supply, and at the same time, we're trying to restrict our oil supply by making fake oil here through ethanol. And we're subsidizing both of them. We subsidize the countries overseas. We subsidize the governments. We have military there that cost us a fortune. And now we're going to subsidize the building of plants for ethanol here. Folks, if you can't see that this is a major monumental problem, this Leviathan, you know, that's absolutely out of control, spending our money in a haphazard, nonsensical way that could only result in financial disaster. That's the only conclusion. If you cannot see that, you know, you've got a problem. You're going to be walking around with rose-colored glasses. This is a real problem. This whole game, this whole charade is going to stop someday. You cannot continue to intervene in the marketplace, in the free market. I want to read something to you that I thought was interesting. Here, talking about the marketplace. I'm sorry, I'm constantly reading stuff, so I get all these articles. And I'm going to read this word for word. This is from the Foundation of Economic Education, another fantastic organization, which I recommend that you go to their website. And this is an article by, it says, Ethanol versus the Poor, by Gardner Goldsmith. And he says this about the market. He says, the market encompasses and integrates every market sector. It represents the dynamic flow of usable capital, time, natural resources, skills, preferences, and opportunities each participant uses to fulfill his needs. Only the individual can make the proper judgments about these factors. And when he participates in any market sector, he helps establish a price system that imparts this information to other participants of not only his sector, but others as well. As a result, absent political interference, the political needs of market participants drive capital, time, skills, and other resources to their most productive uses, maximizing human effort in all sectors and minimizing waste. But by imposing their will on participants in the market for fuel, politicians not only commit the unethical act of coercion, they intercede in and interfere with the proper flow of capital in all sectors of the market. Now, folks, that says it all. That says it absolutely all. The government gets in there and interrupts the free market. And the true pricing of what everything should cost. All the opportunity costs are built in. And we all make that decision. We are all part of that market, like we're all part of society. And by making decisions every single day, if I decide that gasoline is too expensive, I may not take a drive, you know, to watch the leaves turn in Arkansas. So I may stay home. I make that I make that choice, and by doing so, I buy no gasoline. That affects the market and affects everyone attached to that market and otherwise. It affects the people who make cars, people who grow the rubber trees, I mean, who make the tires. And you see how this whole thing is a very complex system, and you cannot follow it. There's no way to make some sort of line diagram to or per chart to show how each thing is interrelated. It's impossible. But when the government intercedes, it breaks that. We no longer make those decisions based on what is best for me as the consumer, the ultimate consumer. Now the government is making that decision for us while taking our money to back up the logic of their decision, and that's disaster. All right, now. There's another article here, and this is in USA Today. It says, study, this ethanol production brings water risks. This is very interesting. I had not thought of this before because I knew ethanol was a boondoggle and a bad idea from the word go. And it says this, both water quality, and this article, by the way, is Washington AP. Okay. Both water quality and the availability of water could be threatened by sharply increasing crops such as corn. Says Gerald L. Schooner, professor of environmental engineering and co-director of the Center of Global and Regional Environmental Research at the University of Iowa. Obviously someone who knows what the heck he's talking about. He says, it takes 2,000 gallons of water for every bushel of corn. That's a high amount of water, he says. And that's in addition to the secondary use of how much water is needed by factories that produce the ethanol. What is needed is a breakthrough in technology so ethanol can be produced from cellulose such as grass and wood and sawdust, Schooner said. If we could do that, it would be a much, much better environmentally. Brazil uses waste from cane to fuel its ethanol factories while the United States uses natural gas or other fuels. It goes on to say, and I'll end this note, the report notes that water is an increasingly precious resource. And I've heard, I'm going to interrupt this reading for a second, because I think we've all heard that when the next war that's fought is not going to be over oil, it's going to be over water. Water is a worldwide resource which is stressed and in demand. And in some places, do you know out of 6 billion people in this world, 1 billion people have no water whatsoever, and 2 billion, one-third of the world's population, have access to water that is not even drinkable. I mean, water is where the next confrontations will come from, will be the result of confrontations or the cause of confrontations, because governments are not doing anything. They're squandering the money instead of doing things for the people within their own countries. All right, he says here, it's an increasingly precious resource used for many purposes, including drinking and other municipal uses, hydropower, cooling, thermoelectric plants, manufacturing, recreation, habitat for fish, wildlife, and agriculture. Supplies are already stressed in some areas of the country, including a large region where water is drawn from underground aquifers, which extend from West Texas up to South Dakota and Wyoming. Folks, with 36 billion gallons a year being produced of ethanol, the water, our water sheds, our water supplies will be strained, absolutely strained. It is ethanol is an absolutely super dumb idea. And now, when, because we are growing more ethanol because of the high subsidies, and everyone's making big money on corn these days, they're doing it at the expense of other crops. So other crops are being pushed out of the farming picture, which is raising the price of the few crops that are available, because you have a shortage of supply and you still have a high demand for these crops. Now, the people who are going to suffer, there was a speech given by in March of 2007 by no one who's friendly to the free market, but he made a good point, and that's our friend Fidel Castro. And he said, by the United States pursuing the pursuing ethanol and subsidizing the ethanol production in the United States, you know, for our automobiles, basically, he says, what we are doing is we are creating mass starvation around the world. Now, of course, he dramatized it, you know, over and above, but he's on the right track, and he makes a good point. Now, please, no one send me email telling me that, you know, I think Castro's a wonderful, good person and all that. I'm just saying that, you know, here's a guy who typically never makes a good point. You know, he just sounds good, but he made a good point. And although he exaggerated it probably and he dramatized it a little bit too much, but that's his style. But he made the point that by making by our food crops, which are very, very inexpensive for people, even people around the world, because of our efficient agriculture, we are driving that price up, meaning that it's becoming more expensive for other people to get foods. Now, where does that come from? Well, there are organizations that get food stuff or buy food stuff from, you know, from the government, and they give it basically, you know, to foreign countries, to countries of people that are starving. Well, now that there's a shortage, they can't get that food stuff anymore. They got to pay more for it. They don't have the money. So they get less food for the buck, which means more people are going to starve. And I think this is what Castro was saying. But he makes a good point. There's nothing good about ethanol. There's not a damn good thing about ethanol. Corn is traditionally made up 40% of the diet of cattle. Well, with the price of corn going up, the price of food is going up. What about the people in the poor people who buy bread? Buy tortillas, for example, corn tortillas. Well, that price is going up. You see how it affects everyone. There's an article here from, geez, I don't even know who it's from. Immaterial. Anyway, it says, what is good news for grain farmers is grim news for cattle, hog, and poultry producers, who buy the majority of the nation's feed corn and have counted on low prices to keep costs down from feedlot to food store. Corn means everyone from breeders along rural byways to consumers in urban centers will feel the pain. People will be paying more for cornflakes and more for meat counter. Now, you know, it goes beyond that, folks. If you look at the American diet, so much of our American diet contains what, corn sweetener, you know, and sugar, and then they have, you know, corn, whatever it is, you know. Anyway, it's about in everything, and that's going to go up. Even our Coca-Cola, bottles of Coca-Cola will go up. Well, the prices will soar, people will buy less. More people will starve. Our environment will be raped. Our consumers will pay more. The poor will make less. A few farmers will make a hell of a lot of money. And then now we know why the top 1% makes 21% of the total income, because of government regulations. Don't blame the people. Blame the government. Folks, I'm tired. I don't know about you. If you've been listening to me, you'll know that this has been a tough evening for me. Well, this is the end of tonight's broadcast. We'd like to thank Ranch Acres Audiology for their financial support, and we'd like to thank you for listening in. You can further the cause of liberty by recommending this program to your friends. And please, send me your email to comments@libertytalkradio.com. That's comments@libertytalkradio.com. Don't forget to visit my friend's Andy Sutton's website, mytwocentsonline.com, and get briefed up on economic issues that directly affect you. And remember, folks, don't steal. The government hates competition. Thursday morning, 6:30 a.m., we'll be broadcasting live again. Please check the blog for the what subject we'll be covering. I'm not sure what that'll be yet, but we'll pick a subject and we'll run with it. All right? Until then, stay well, stay tuned. Good night.